artificial intelligence will completely transform our world. But what is AI? Why will it affect you? And how can you and your business survive and thrive through the AI revolution? Welcome to AI and You. Here is your host, author, speaker, and futurist, Peter Scott.
Hello, and this is episode 198. I am talking with Eve Herold, author of the new book, Robots and the People Who Love Them, Holding On to Our Humanity in an Age of Social Robots. Eve is an award-winning science writer and consultant in the scientific and medical nonprofit space. She writes about issues at the crossroads of science and society, and has been featured in Vice, Medium, The Boston Globe, The Wall Street Journal, Prevention, The Kiplinger Report, and The Washington Post, and on MSNBC, NPR, and CNN. Last week, we talked about how people, including soldiers in combat, get attached to AIs and robots. We discussed Eliza Wobot and Samantha from the movie Her, and the role of robots in helping take care of us physically and emotionally, among many other topics. Let's get back into the interview with Eve Herold. You gave the example of soldiers who held funerals for and cried over the damage to robots that were protecting them from, like, improvised explosive devices in Iraq. And that is certainly something that I don't want to suggest is frivolous in any way, because these are people that have been through a great deal of training on how to stay alive in difficult situations. One would imagine that they don't ascribe the same level of emotion to, say, their bulletproof vests, which have saved their lives to an equal extent. So is there something there that's revealing about the nature of robots and human interaction?
Yes, there very much is. And I think the same dynamics that people fall into in a private robot relationship that, say, a companion robot, are the same kind of instincts that would come into play in a military situation, because you have, again, you have all, even though some of these robots look really utilitarian, I'm sure you've seen some of them, very few of them are humanoid at all. But again, it doesn't take that much to really enthrall a human being with the idea that when they see something moving, following orders, appearing to act intelligently, in addition to standing between them and death, then yes, those same feelings of attachment tend to come into play. And these soldiers really grieve over the loss of these robots. I mean, they've named them, they've given them personalities and backstories, they're attached to them. Hmm. So it's an interesting phenomenon.
And as you say in the book, that might even lead to some unintended consequences. The robots are put in these situations precisely because they are considered expendable. But if the soldiers they work with don't feel that, we may lose one of the reasons that they were put there. And so that becomes something tricky to negotiate.
The whole question of military robots is tricky to negotiate. There are so many issues there. And I mean, I think one of the biggest ones is almost a public relations issue. Are we going to put robots in the field and take a risk of something terrible happening, you know, a robot somehow going offline and doing the wrong thing, doing something very destructive because these have powerful weapons on them? Or are we going to try to keep a handle on that? Because if something like that happened, it would be a huge public relations disaster for the government, the military. You would have big, big questions of who was liable. Say 100 civilians were killed in a village when the robot thought they were terrorists. Who's going to take responsibility? What is the enemy going to claim? They're going to claim that it was intentional. It could have an escalating effect. Mm. We need to really parse this out and use them wisely and in a limited way as well.
And then there are some of the darker sides of the ways that we interact with robots. Recently, people set upon a self-driving car in, I think, San Francisco, set it on fire. There was also a bot a few years ago called Hitchbot. It wasn't much of a robot, but it had some electronics in it, and its purpose was a psychological experiment to see if people would give it a ride across the country, and they would see it at the side of the road with a mechanical thumb stuck out and take it on board, take it as far as they were going in that direction, and drop it off at the side of the road again. And it managed to go across Canada in this fashion. And then in a somewhat revealing incident, they decided to try the same thing in the United States, and it got less than 100 miles, I think, in Pennsylvania before it was found dismembered in a ditch. Particularly with respect to self-driving cars, but also other situations. I'm reminded of a rather poignant movie called Chappie about a robot that was fictional, but it was growing up and it was rather childlike, and it was mercilessly taken advantage of and abused. Talk about the ways in which our relationship with robots or chatbots could and do cause sometimes the worst of us to come out.
It's a very important question. And it's true that they do sometimes cause the worst in people to come out because of the sense of no consequences. And the concern is that if people become habituated to relationships with robots, you know, on a day-to-day basis, that they feel free to abuse in any way they see fit. The robot's not pushing back. There are no consequences. So some of these behaviors could then carry over into their human relationships. And this is something that is of concern, and it's been seen in studies with children sometimes. You know, there's always the bully in the schoolyard. And some of these children are very destructive towards robots that they're given to interact with and just habitually abuse them. So do we want to be learning those kind of behaviors? And that's another area where a sense of perspective is really called for, and even a sense in some people of really limiting their interaction with robots.
It seems to me, as a hypothesis, that the people who would abuse robots are also the people more likely to abuse animals, to take advantage of any entity less powerful than themselves. Has anyone looked at that?
Not that I'm aware of, but that would be a fascinating study, because intuitively, I have to agree with you. I think people who already have those tendencies would take easily to mistreating a robot. And the question is, would that exacerbate the tendency, or would it channel it and siphon it off? And nobody seems to have an answer to that question. I wondered about that the whole time I was writing this book, and I never did find any research specifically on that. We have a long way to go before we truly understand this stuff.
There is a lot more to be found out than we've already found out. You quote McDorman as saying that he believes that uncanny robots incite in us brief flashes of our own mortality, something psychologists refer to as animal reminders. I found that intriguing. I had not thought of and uncanny robots, and here we're talking about the ones that are close enough to be human to make us think that this is a human with something wrong with it. This term that came out of the Polar Express movie, where the characters were animated enough to look human, but
they were scary, creepy.
And I had not thought about that as being something that somehow reminded me of our own mortality. Can you explain that one to me?
So that all goes back to this level of confusion in our brains when we're encountering these robots over whether they're alive or dead, whether they're real or artificial. And there's a whole long literary cultural tradition that plays upon this universal, I would say, well, nigh universal tendency. When you start talking about things like zombies and Frankenstein, he's not quite dead, but he's not really alive either, and werewolves and all the rest of it. And it is something that is kind of intrinsic, I think, in human nature. I mean, and I find it fascinating because I often wonder why or how people can really get into these really gory movies where there's just unbelievable bloodshed and cruelty and horrific things. And I just wonder what mechanism in our brains is attracting us to that. And I think many people do have a murky side of their consciousness. Freud would say all people have this, but I would say many people have this, this side to their unconscious mind that is both attracted and repelled by things that remind them of death and mortality. It's not necessarily something we're thinking about on a conscious basis all the time, but it's there. And when we interact, there are cues. We have visual and auditory and sensory cues that can turn that impulse on and trip the wires and give us that flash of death and mortality. Mm. It's part of the human condition.
You've written in the book about elderly people not wanting to get a dog because it would outlive them.
Mm-hmm.
Do they not also, one would think, have the same reaction to a robot that would definitely outlive them? One of the ones that they give to people in care homes in particular for them to take care of, like Paro, the seal robot?
And that's another area, Peter, that I think needs more research, but it's something that really we need to kind of be careful about when we're using robots with vulnerable people, like people with dementia. Now, I don't know if a person with advanced dementia would really have any concern about their Paro seal, baby seal robot outliving them, but maybe they would because they're having trouble distinguishing reality. And I don't know. I honestly don't have answers for that, but I think it's an area that needs to be studied in terms of people who are especially vulnerable to these relationships and to being deceived, not in a harmless way, but in a harmful way.
Well, that question and the others that we've raised here brings me to one of the things you say in the book. I will quote, "Very little research asks whether we should have social robots. The vast majority is focused on how to make robots more appealing in order to better facilitate their acceptance. Arguably, it's not the job of roboticists to ask these types of questions. Such discussions fit better in the realms of philosophy, psychology, and social studies." End quote. At what point do we need roboticists to ask these questions? At what point do we need cross-fertilization between the people who are developing these things and the people who can understand their psychological and social impacts?
Well, we need it very badly. We need cross-cultural interaction on this. And it is happening to some extent. And one example is Wobot, the therapy robot, which was developed by a team of specialists, some of whom were psychologists and some who were roboticists and engineers. And there are attempts like that being made to really make this as culturally, ethically safe as it can be. So I think we're making progress. And again, the further we move down this road of having these robots and learning to interact with them, the more information we'll have and the better we will be potentially able to design them and put safeguards and regulate them in a way that makes their adoption as positive as it can possibly be. Not that it will probably ever be perfect, but you can maximize it.
And I think we can see what tomorrow in the West might be by looking to Japan, which you mention has a lot of robot research and robot uptake, primarily because of their demographics. They have a much higher ratio of elderly people to young people due to various policies, and that means there aren't enough young people to look after the old people. They are going to have robots to do that at some point. And you also talked about the prevalence of loneliness in Japan and the use of social robots in the same context. Do you have a sense of why loneliness is so acute in Japan?
That's a very good question. But I think, you know, if I had to guess, I would say it must have something somehow to do with the economic structure of Japan. Because you look at the way the workplace really takes over the lives of people, the long, long hours they work. They don't have time for socializing. They don't have energy for socializing, dating, getting married, and having children because their lives are consumed by their work. And I think that plays a role. And there are probably other currents in Japanese culture as well that somehow play a role. But I do find it a bit ironic and a bit unintuitive because Asian cultures in general are very interconnected and community oriented. And I'm not sure why Japan is set to the side here in a very different kind of social milieu. But I think that it's something that, as you said, part of it will be relieved by robots. And the fact that you have the demographic changes of an aging population and a very low birth rate, declining population, something's got to give. And I think robots could really be not the optimal solution, maybe, but definitely a help.
And I'm just reminded to point out here that this conversation or those attributions don't apply to all of Japan. There is Okinawa, which is politically part of Japan, although it's been a ping pong ball in the past, and that has an extraordinary degree of social cohesion there. I've witnessed it firsthand, and is likely one of the reasons why they're a blue zone where people live to 100 years old routinely.
Yeah.
We are looking at robots evolving in the commercial sphere and every other sphere at a phenomenal rate right now. And we're on the cusp of robots going into production for consumer use that are bipedal, anthropomorphic, doing some kind of useful task. I'm still waiting to find out exactly what, but by many accounts, places are tooling up to manufacture these things by the thousands. And that could just reshape things. I mean, certainly our minds turn to all kinds of precedent where Hollywood is only too happy to supply us with dystopian visions of robots marching down the street to enslave us. What are some of the more useful ways in which we should prepare ourselves for an unprecedented integration of that kind of robot into our lives?
I think we need to start thinking and examining our own attitudes about this now. There are a lot of issues to think through here and how we approach this. And I think these robots are going to become more useful. I do think the addition of AI makes them, of course, extremely versatile and extremely useful. And I think it's coming. And I think we need to kind of start to ascertain what they are and what they're not, and what we are and what we're not, and understand kind of the demarcations between the different types of intelligence that we tend to kind of revere in industrialized countries, which is the type of intelligence that we see robots as being very high in, which is computational intelligence. And these are great, valuable tools, but they're tools. And I think we also need to have a renewed examination and appreciation of the many different types of intelligence that humans bring to the table, whether it's creative, emotional, moral, spiritual. There's many types of intelligence that human beings are capable of. And with all the talk about artificial general intelligence, I'm very curious about this, about where it's going to lead. But everything that I've seen so far that I've read kind of tells me that we're not really on the cusp of general intelligence, because adding more computational intelligence is not going to bring the full palette into the mind of a robot of the different types of intelligence that make up a human being. But again, our culture really values computational intelligence. And so, and that's all fine and great. We're fascinated, we're amused, we're entertained by all of this. But we need to start thinking about it on a deeper level.
Well, we could be headed quite soon towards a society where one of one's co-workers happens to be a robot. By some accounts, Amazon is heading full tilt towards automating the packing and replacing humans in their warehouses. And so these could become ubiquitous in some sense. Let's do a little thought experiment for fun here. Just imagine that these things become available. They're at a reasonable price point for what they can do. It might be in the thousands of dollars, but still might be able to do the dishes, vacuum the stairs, which the Roomba can't do, or polish the car, that sort of thing. And you can go down the street to a dealership and look them over and get one. Come home with one, it'll walk home behind you, get in the car, whatever, maybe that level of capability. Would you get one? What would you look for? Would it be an experiment? Would it be something you would look forward to? Would it be something you would fear?
It's something I would definitely look for. I would want it to do all of the handy, helpful things that we envision robots doing for us, taking the drudgery out of, you know, a life to some extent, doing the dishes, cleaning the floor, mopping the floor, doing the windows. I would love to have a cook, but I would also love to have my own kind of digital library filled with information about subjects that I'm keenly interested in, and be able to discuss those with me and inform me and educate me on a regular basis through conversation, and be to some extent a very intelligent and intellectually stimulating companion. But here we're, you know, we're already getting into that gray area there where, you know, I'm saying, well, we have to be careful about all this stuff, and we do. But no, I think it can be done. I think we will eventually get to the point where we have exquisitely particularized versions of ourselves almost in these robots that will keep us intellectually engaged and enrich our lives.
These kind of conversations and most of what we've been talking about just reminds me of how AI and these kind of robots provide a mirror for us to learn more about our own humanity. It's just that some people don't look in it. Some people don't know that the mirror is there. People like you and me want to look in it to find out what we can see.
And that's the crux of the issue, is that when you're in a relationship with a robot, you're in a relationship with yourself. And that is the idea that we need to take firm hold of as a culture and a society. We don't have that muscle right now. We're kind of like, we don't have the muscles we need to do that, but we'll develop them.
I've got children in elementary school and high school. What do you think it will be like for people 10, 15 years from now as young adults who have grown up in a world of helper robots?
I think it's going to be a very different culture. And I say that because kind of past experience with the rate of change that we've experienced in recent decades with the advance of new technology and the pace at which young people are so adaptive and so accepting of new technologies and in a lot of ways very creative with it. So I think that these young people we'll have different categories of relationships than what we're used to, but they will have a much keener sense of perspective on what can be done with them, how they can be utilized, maximized, how they can enrich your life, and they'll do that. I think there will be other people who will struggle and have problems with the dividing line between fantasy and reality. And things along that nature. I think there will be some psychological issues for some people. And we'll have to develop some kind of system that deals with that too. Whether it's a mental health system or we teach it in our schools, we teach robot literacy in our schools. I don't know. I think we kind of need to hit all the notes on this.
So much territory to cover here. The question of sentience in robots, the ability to feel. They are certainly at the moment able to do a imitation of that that's improving all of the time. The chatbots have demonstrated that to a degree that wasn't even anticipated by the people who wrote about Data in Star Trek. And one can see that this is only going to get better and better. Yet, as you say, and as practically everyone would agree at the moment, those robots do not have emotion. So when does the difference between us believing that robots have emotions and them actually having them or not having them become an acute issue?
It becomes an acute issue as soon as we start to become emotionally dependent on them. And I think that is going to happen pretty quickly. I think once we get into these daily interactions with these intelligent sounding and acting and looking robots, at least acting and sounding, that we're going to go down that road. There's attachments will be formed. And that's where it is. And that's, again, that's part of that whole dividing line that we need to be clear on. Robots to date are not sentient. And we need to be clear about that. It sounds very obvious and very easy, but it's when you start to interact with these things, and the research is very solid on this. People of all walks of life, even very intelligent, rational people, are as vulnerable to being seduced by inter-robot relationships as the rest of us. So it's something that we need to be aware of, but I don't see anything coming down the pike in the foreseeable future that would give sentience to robots. And again, I go back to that as far as innovation in robotics, aside from the physical material innovations that are going at leaps and bounds right now, the innovation that would lead them to be sentient and to have emotions has yet to be discovered. Mm. Because as I said earlier, just adding more computational power to an AI is not going to make it sentient. It's going to give it greater computational power.
Right.
And it's not exactly the same thing.
But we don't know. Can you imagine a time when they have evolved to the point where we have run out of ways of telling that they aren't sentient? We literally have no way to tell from the outside that they are not sentient.
Wow. Now you're getting into some really kind of Blade Runner type of territory here, where you have androids, very, very realistic androids that seem to be emotional and behave very appropriately in an intricate human relationship. So I don't know, but I think that a lot of people will cross that threshold earlier than we think, even before we get to the Blade Runner androids. I think there are a lot of people in the world who kind of don't have a totally firm grip on the dividing line between reality and unreality, between fantasy and unreality. And in a lot of ways, we're all like that, because we're all encouraged by a culture that gives us movies and books and videos and stories that we become incredibly enmeshed in. And there are parts of our brains that are reacting to them as if they were real.
Mm.
This is nothing to be ashamed of. It's just human nature. But it is something to be a little cautious about when it comes to relationships with robots.
I have to quote the bumper sticker here. Reality is for people who can't handle science fiction. Our time on this planet is all too finite, particularly this part of it. So as we wrap up, what thoughts or anecdotes would you like to leave our audience with? And then where should they go to find out more about what you're doing and, of course, to get your book?
Well, I'm kind of moving a little more into the area of AI as it drives a phenomenon called social contagion. And people automatically think, well, you're talking about misinformation being spread on social media. And yes, we're talking about that. But we're also talking about how robots will change the fabric of society. They'll change the way people interact, the way we speak, the emotional range that we employ on a regular basis. They will change the culture. And I think that's inevitable. And that's kind of where I'm going with my next writing. But you can get the book at any bookseller. It's Robots and the People Who Love Them. And it's published by St. Martin's Press, which is an imprint of Macmillan's. And it's available in bookstores. So, and I also have a website, which is eveherold.com.
Well, thank you. The book, again, Robots and the People Who Love Them, Holding Onto Our Humanity in an Age of Social Robots. Eve Herold, thank you so much for enlightening us and coming on AI and You.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much, Peter.
That's the end of the interview. What a time to be alive when AI and robots are evolving so fast that our relationships with them are changing daily. There's so much change to both look forward to and also take responsibility for making these disruptions come out positively for us. And I'm glad to have had one of the people doing that on the show in the person of Eve. In today's news ripped from the headlines about AI, researchers at Western Sydney University in Australia have teamed up with Intel and Dell to build a massive supercomputer intended to simulate neural networks at the scale of the human brain. They say the computer, dubbed Deep South, is capable of emulating networks of spiking neurons at 228 trillion synaptic operations per second, putting it on par with the estimated rate at which the human brain completes operations. It is scheduled to begin operation next month. Professor Andre van Schaik said, quote, "Progress in our understanding of how brains compute using neurons is hampered by our inability to simulate brain-like networks at scale. Doing that, simulating spiking neural networks on standard computers using graphics processing units and multi-core central processing units is just too slow and power-intensive. Our system will change that." End quote. Next week, my guest will be Jerome C. Glenn, co-founder and CEO of the Millennium Project on Global Futures Research and co-organizer of the Beneficial Artificial General Intelligence Summit, recently held in Panama City. That's next week on AI and You. Until then, remember, no matter how much computers learn how to do, it's how we come together as humans that matters.
That's all for this episode of AI and You. Please leave a rating and comment and share with your friends. Get the book Artificial Intelligence and You and see more videos and articles at aiandyou.net. That's aiandyou.net, where you can also send us your questions. Thank you for listening.